And we stand like that for a while, until I say, I feel exactly the same way.
We're running out of time, Lissa says.
And I break away from Essie and see that she has been there all along.
Say what you came to say.
Essie takes a deep breath and starts. The book. I just don't think I can put it out there. Not anymore. Is this because of Libby? I ask. She sounded worried that she said something that went too far. She reminded me of the truth, that's all. You tried to tell me to. I just wasn't ready to hear it. There are too many people who will be hurt. Caleb deserves more than a little hurt, I tell her. And your parents? I know they weren't right in the room with you, but they still let it happen. That means that they deserve some too. Essie brushes her hand across her forehead, even though there's not a single hair out of place. It's not just Caleb or my parents who would be hurt by the things that are in the book. There'll be questions about Lissa too, about why she left. Isn't it best to leave some things buried? To leave the past behind? Lissa raises a hand, palm toward her sister.
Leave me out of this. I don't need protection. I already told you what I think.
Which is? I ask.
That if I had been braver, I would have done what Essie did.
But I wasn't, and I ran.
What happened to Essie is my fault as much as it is Caleb's. My silence made it possible. Her silence now could do the same. He could hurt another girl. We don't have any more sisters, Essie protests.
Do you really think that will stop him? Lissa responds. Essie is silent. Her eyes fall. Maybe there's a way for both of you to be right, I say, trying to diffuse the tension. There are other ways, less public ones, to make sure Caleb is dealt with. It doesn't have to be this one.
Anything having to do with Caleb is public, Lissa answers, especially now that the campaign is underway.
Maybe he'd be willing to bow out quietly. Lissa ignores this and turns to Essie.
Who are you really trying to protect?
Essie's hands flutter at her side and then bury themselves in the fabric of her dress.
We were a family once. We were happy. It's not just Daddy or Mother or Caleb. The others never asked for this. Think of what it will do to Naomi and to Millie and little Nate. Their entire world will collapse in on them. How do you come back from that?
Is it better for Millie to grow up with a child molester in the house? Lissa asks quietly, and there is a deadness in her voice that is frightening.
I'm just not ready,
Essie sighs.
I'm not brave enough. I thought I was, but now I know I'm not.
It's fine, Lissa says, taking her sister into her arms.
It's fine. I'm sorry. Don't worry about a thing.
I leave the girls and wander back toward the bathroom. My face in the mirror is jarring in its familiarity. I had expected to look changed somehow. More like my father. It was surprising how quickly I rushed to judgment. How certain I felt that it was impossible for the Hicks family to be worthy of Essie's compassion. Her forgiveness. As if how you feel about your family ever makes any sense at all. I should know this better than most, because forgiveness is exactly what I gave my own parents years ago. The sign at the roadside was welcoming. The stone wall quaint, like something out of a storybook. The farmhouse was visible only after we had turned onto the dirt lane that led away from the main highway. White clapboard, black shutters and trim. Only the door was red. There were other buildings as well, but I wouldn't see them until later. I remember that there was a wooden swing hung from the branch of an English oak in the yard beside the house. It looked like a child lived there. It's possible that one did. After that first meeting with the director in his sitting room, I never went back inside. Once Dad left, they took me down the hill, down behind the barn, down where the animals were kept. Even looking back, there was nothing to suggest what was about to happen. Nothing I can think of that might have served as a warning. I went in completely blind. Blake asked me later why I hadn't written to him at camp like I said I would. But I couldn't. I couldn't write down what was happening, but I couldn't pretend it away either. So I just concentrated on surviving, on getting through the days. The days, at least, were predictable. Up at 6, muck out stalls, dig holes for fence posts or for a new latrine. There was some tasteless food, the occasional fight between two of the other boys to break up the monotony. There were the sessions where we were handed baseball bats and encouraged to hit a life-sized dummy. We were supposed to be working through our anger issues, our hatred toward our fathers, or something. I recognized that not all of the boys sent to Holden Park were like me. Some were like Caleb, though I wouldn't have put it that way at the time. I only knew that they were not to be trusted. None of them. It was safer that way. Safer, not safe. So yes, the days were predictable. Boring even. It was the nights when the real learning took place. The sun set late that time of year. But even so, the rooms where they had us wrap our arms around each other were dark. The physical contact brought an intimacy I found unsettling. Sitting between the legs of a stranger, I would force myself to relax against him, rest my head on his shoulder, allow his arms to encase me completely. I would concentrate on the feel of his heart thudding dully against my shoulder blades and try to slow my breathing. These sessions weren't meant to be sexual, were in fact meant to realign whatever neurons or chakras had gotten out of whack and turned us into the monsters that we were. Still, there were a fair number of erections that would rub against my back during these periods, when we were holding or being held. I tried to ignore them. I tried to imagine I was somewhere else. I must have been doing an all right job of floating through unnoticed, of seeming receptive to the program, because I was never singled out for some of the more intensive sessions, the ones that took place in the barn at night and were witnessed only by the animals. You could hear them when they happened. The thud of a fist hitting soft flesh, the muffled groans, the crying that came after. The dormitory would be silent when the door opened to admit the returning boy. I remember sleeping with my head beneath my pillow. I remember biting down on my tongue to stop from screaming. I remember the taste of my own blood. Toward the end of the summer, one of the boys snuck out to the barn at night and hanged himself from the rafters. I found the body when I went to get a pitchfork for morning chores. His face was purple, swollen. I couldn't remember his name, and in that moment, that was the thing that seemed to me the saddest. That he was already starting to be forgotten. I should have yelled for help, but I didn't. Somehow shouting in his presence seemed disrespectful. Also, I didn't want them to see him that way. The counselors, the camp director, the people who had driven him to it. I found a saw and climbed into the rafters and drew the blade across the thick rope. I worked furiously, but even so, I wasn't fast enough. The others entered the barn just as I was about to slice through the last few rough strands. The director barked at me to freeze. I did. and then the rope gave way. The body fell. There was a sickening thud as it hit the wide pine floor.
"What did you think you were doing?"
the director asked me later. And I had answered. I was afraid he couldn't breathe. But that was a lie. I knew that he was dead. They locked the dormitories while the boy's parents came to retrieve the body. But I could see them from the bathroom window. It had rained heavily that morning. But the rain was stopping by the time they pulled their station wagon down the long drive. His mother wore a raspberry-colored coat and rain hat that seemed out of place. They were too bright against the brown grass, the gray puddles in the sandy mud. His father was much older. His back stooped, his face sagging. I was struck by how ordinary they both looked. How completely devoid of dangerousness. They didn't look the way we had all been taught that murderers would appear, wearing hoodies and wielding knives. But they had killed their son just the same. Caleb has joined the others when I get back to the room.
You get lost?
Reggie asks with a chuckle. I shake my head. My stomach, I say. I guess I'm really nervous.
It's just about that time, Caleb says. Nervous or not, we'd better head upstairs.
The tunnel that takes us beneath the church proper is dimly lit. Our shoes click on the painted concrete floor. We wait in the sacristy while Gretchen goes to fetch the microphones. While we loiter, Caleb slides up close beside me and places a hand on my shoulder.
You've been a good sport about all this, I have to say.
I'm not sure I'd have had your patience. I shrug against the weight of his touch. It'll all be over soon.
That's not what I meant.
I meant getting saddled with my sister. She's a sweet little thing, but we both know she's damaged. I look around the room in disbelief. Caleb is not making any effort to keep his voice down. I wonder if he's drunk or just crazy. Or maybe seeing her sold off is harder on him than I would have thought. Who knows what sort of twisted feelings he might have for her? What fantasies are ruined by my being here? I tell Caleb, I see Essie for who she is, and she sees me. Flaws and all. No secrets. It's a more honest relationship than most have. More honest than yours, for instance. Caleb brings his eyebrows together.
What makes you think I keep secrets from my wife? What sort of husband do you think I am?
He looks genuinely offended. For a moment, I don't realize what he's implying. And then the gravity of what he's saying sinks in. I speak slowly and say, How does that work, exactly? Now Caleb begins to smile.
To love, cherish, and obey. Isn't that how the vows go? If you're lucky, your wife will do the same.
I speak before I can stop myself. Aren't you at all worried? Essie's about to be free of you. She could take you down.
Maybe, Caleb answers.
His tone is even, confident.
But she won't.
She's smart.
She can't say anything, not without destroying her own life as well. The he said, she said thing never plays out well. She wouldn't want to live through that. Besides, she has no proof.
I raise my eyebrows and force myself to swallow before I say, Well, then I guess you're safe. Gretchen comes over with Caleb's microphone. Caleb smirks at me and walks toward the door that leads out to the chancel. I force myself to stand still while Gretchen fastens my own microphone onto my lapel, and then, still feeling dizzy, I step into line. I find my taped mark on the steps before the altar and struggle to remain in place while the organ transitions from its prelude to the bridal chorus. There's more brass than usual. I see Lev Gottlieb in the front row of musicians. He opens the spit valve and gives his trumpet a shake before lifting the instrument to his lips. Then Essie appears at the back of the church. At first, I can't make out her features. She is so far away. The crowd turns, and there's a flutter of handkerchiefs, raised to blot out tears. Ever so slowly, Essie comes into focus. And I will her to hurry, so I don't have to be up here alone. Finally, Pastor Hicks is lifting her veil, and I step down to meet them. He kisses her cheek and turns to shake my hand. Essie steps up beside me, and I place a hand over my microphone and lean toward her. Naomi knew, I breathe through my teeth. She doesn't deserve your protection. None of them do. She knew everything.
Liberty. When we finished up taping in the church basement, Margo and I claim a pew in the back of the church by a side door so that we can slip out when the recessional starts. We'll meet Rourke and Essie on the front steps for their final interview. Margo takes my phone and starts live tweeting from my account. She tells me my number of followers has tripled since just last week. Your followers, you mean, I say. Margo shrugs. What they don't know won't hurt them. She has dyed her hair brown for the occasion, with just a fringe of lavender remaining in her bangs. She called it going undercover, this casting off of her usual purple spikes. But she said it with a grin that showed she realized changing her hair color would never be enough to make her fit in. Not here. She has made an effort, though. She's not wearing an actual dress or anything that extreme, but her slacks and top are light gray. They blend in well enough with the pastel Easter parade. The crowd filing into the seats is clearly aware of how many people will be watching this on TV. Perhaps I am being unkind. It is a holiday, after all. Even Mama got us a little bit dressed up on Easter. Maybe that's the reason for all the fuss, but in any case, there are an astonishing number of hats, and they seem like just the sort of marker that would allow you to recognize yourself from behind if the camera happened to pan over your section of the congregation. There are fresh flowers set upon wide brims, but also other fussier concoctions. Tall feathers projecting little spikes from delicate beadwork, satin roses, and even actual painted eggs lying in a nest of crinoline. I know what Mama would think if she were here. How she'd roll her eyes. She was always dismissive of the sort of pageantry the Hicks family seems to relish, to have perfected. Getting gussied up in lace gloves and a ridiculous hat won't bring you any closer to God, Mama would say. It's hard work that does that. Caring for the animals and land that he has entrusted to you, that raises you up in his eyes. Then I would nod obediently and head back to the barn to finish the chores I was hoping she'd let slide. Mama is awake now, or so the doctors said. Last night, after talking to Essie, I called the house again even though I didn't really expect anyone to answer. It had become a ritual of sorts. To listen to the ringing, wondering if anyone was home to hear, to imagine the way the sound traveled through the rooms where I had grown up. When the windows in the living room were cracked, you could hear the kitchen phone ringing in the side yard, the one with the seesaw Pa and Topher built, and that Justice fell off when she was six, splitting open her chin. It took 8 stitches to close the cut, and I remember watching the doctor intently fascinated by the yellow bubbles of fat, the glistening curve of the needle that gave way to a filament so thin it was practically invisible. "Will it scar?" Mama had asked.
"Every cut scars, at least a little bit, but it came together nicely. Over time, you might not even be able to see that it was ever there." That night, I snuck a pair of scissors. My plan was to cut the stitches out, to open up the wound again and ensure that it would leave a permanent mark. I liked the idea that there could be something physical that distinguished me from my sister. Some evidence that I and I alone was me. I had never been one for dressing up in matching outfits, and the year we turned 5, I drew a chalk line down the center of our bedroom and forbade Justice from straying over it. I didn't do it to be mean. She was my sister, after all. I loved her fiercely in that way that all siblings love each other, twins in particular. Worship laced through with a shard of resentment. I just wanted something that was mine. The night I took the scissors, Mama stopped me before I even got to the stairs. She reclaimed them without asking what I was doing and returned them to the office drawer. I was unprepared when my father's voice came through the receiver. It was the first time he'd picked up since it happened. I wondered then if he'd been at the hospital during all my earlier calls or if I'd simply worn him down. There was a dead silence on the other end of the line when Pa recognized my voice, and I was afraid that he might hang up. Then he asked, "Why did you do it?" And I could feel the vibration of those words against my cheek as if he had struck me with his open hand. Pa wouldn't tell me any more than I already knew. She's awake. She's breathing on her own. That much I had heard from the doctor, who had doled out these updates sparingly, choosing her words so that she revealed what had been agreed upon, careful not to say anything to which my father had not given his blessing. It seems that Topher had been the one to find her. He had folded up his long limbs to bend down beside her and tilted back her chin to breathe air into her lungs, rolled her on her side, wiped away the vomit, halted the slow wind down of a heart starved for oxygen. He brought her back to life. "I need to let her go," I told my father, and he knew that I meant Justice. "It hurts so much. Even after all these years, and lying about what happened only makes it worse." He didn't speak, but I could hear his breathing. I could tell that he was listening. Finally, when I couldn't bear the silence any longer, I whispered, "Don't you miss her?" This time, the breathing stopped, and its absence seemed louder than what had gone before it.
"I miss you both,"
I heard him say. Then the line went dead. The sun is coming through the stained glass in earnest. There is one section near the top of the window where colors shoot out in all directions in a starburst that looks like I always imagined the beginning of time and the universe would have looked if anyone had been there to see. It is beautiful in the way that such things often are. Once I stare at it long enough, it's less an image and more a feeling. The colors blur, and the after image leaves a warm glow on the insides of my lids. Margot fiddles with my phone while the last of the guests find their seats. The organ swells into a grand finale and then dies away, the prelude finished. There's a cough from somewhere to my right, and another near the front. The final adjustments are made to the cameras near the altar, and then they start broadcasting. Somewhere, I know, before a bank of monitors, an executive producer is furiously barking orders into a headset. I relax into my seat, glad to be a spectator for this part at least. The groomsmen file out to take their places on the stairs. Rourke looks on edge, his shoulders stiff, his chin tilted up unnaturally. Anyone who doesn't know him would just assume that he's nervous. But it's not that. It's Caleb. The air between them is electric, full of static. Though that could be my imagination. Still, I can't shake the feeling that Rourke is on the verge of decking his soon-to-be brother-in-law across the jaw. His fists clench and unclench, and there's a moment when I think he might actually go through with it, might send Caleb crashing to the floor. But then, as one, the congregation stands, and the moment is forgotten. Rourke watches Essie walk down the aisle with such a pure sort of yearning that I almost believe they are in love. His eyes do not waver. Even when he steps forward to meet his bride and her father, and Caleb claps Rourke on the back with brotherly affection, Rourke keeps his gaze fixed only on her. Essie looks truly lovely. When we had spoken in the basement, she was still in just her slip and a dressing gown. The bridesmaids fluttered around her, working at the clasp of a bracelet, adjusting the string of pearls that had been a gift from her sister-in-law Naomi, so that they nestled upon her collarbone just so. Lucy said something about how people were going to cry when they finally saw Essie in her dress, and I had smiled indulgently. But now I see that this is true. In every row, purses are being opened to retrieve Kleenex and real cloth handkerchiefs, and even the men are wiping their eyes. I watch Rourke watching Essie, and am reminded of a poem I learned in school that read in part, "I would like to give you the silver branch, the small white flower, the one word that will protect you." I realize that whatever it is that is between them, even if it's not love, it is just as real. The first part of the ceremony goes quickly. Rourke takes Essie's hand and they turn to face the altar. There's a stretch of kneeling, followed by some standing solemnly with bowed heads. A choir sings. Pastor Hicks talks about the risen Lord. There are a lot of alleluias, some Easter hymns. All the sacrifices ended, followed by Christ the Lord is risen today. Then there is Lift Every Voice and Sing, which was included at Essie's insistence over Celia Hicks's objections. And I watch with amusement as Celia's head wags involuntarily. But the congregation doesn't seem to notice the bit about the blood of the slaughtered. They sing joyfully, and I have to admit that the sheer number of voices is uplifting. I feel my chest expand as the notes climb higher, and I remember what it felt like to be part of something that seemed holy, that seemed like it was all that mattered, that seemed true. But then I notice Margot's amused expression at the irony of this hymn in particular, and I break off singing, and soon it is time to sit down. Pastor Hicks gives a sermon before they proceed with the marriage vows. The wedding party have been given chairs to sit in a little off to one side, so that their faces are turned upward toward the pulpit and visible on camera. In many of the broadcasts I've seen, Pastor Hicks preaches from just in front of the altar for at least a portion of his sermon, or even steps down toward the congregation. He moves among them and the cameras follow. But now, perhaps because the lighting has been so meticulously planned, he takes up residence in his perch and stays there. He looks solemn, and then he calls out, "Christ is risen! Alleluia!" And more than 1,000 pairs of hands come together in clapping or are raised up in the air. "Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter-silvered wings." Without looking down at the pages before him, Pastor Hicks recites the rest of John McGee's poem right through to the part about touching the face of God. His eyes stay fixed on his congregants, as if he is channeling the voice of the Almighty himself,
and speaking his thoughts directly to them.
"That's a beautiful image," he says,
"that you or I might touch the face of God, that we might look upon it and know its love and grace. But we don't have to look upon God to see love. We don't have to look upon his countenance to see grace. Oh, no. We have only to look at these two young people, to look at Essie and Rourke and see that he is moving through them. Their love for each other is his love. Their commitment to each other is the same commitment that he shows to each one of us. His chosen people. His beloved children. And yes, you may well remind me one of these young people is not only his child, she is my child as well. I have the bite marks to prove it."
There is warm laughter. Essie lowers her chin and blushes. Rourke reaches out to squeeze her hand. In living rooms across the country, fathers pull their daughters closer, or so I can only assume. That was the intended effect, no doubt. Margot's thumbs fly over the screen of my phone as she posts to Twitter. She winks at me wickedly. She is enjoying this. Pastor Hicks sighs indulgently and then hushes the crowd. "So what?" you might ask. "Should a father say when he sends his child out into the world? What did our Heavenly Father say to his son? What guidance did he offer as Jesus entered the sometimes dark and difficult world that we live in? Did he tell him to look both ways before crossing the street, as I know all of you have when raising your own sons and daughters? Perhaps he told him not to stay out past 11. That's also good advice. Or maybe, just maybe, he said, be brave. Just that. Such a simple directive, and yet so hard to manage. Be brave, our father might have said, and we would have done well to listen. He stops and looks at Essie tenderly. She meets his gaze, and it's Pastor Hicks who turns away, who drops his head to shuffle his papers before moving on to talk about the resurrection and the light. When he's finished, Rourke and Essie face each other before the altar and promise to honor each other in word and deed. They promise to make a life together that is filled with faith and love and grace. When Rourke slips the ring onto Essie's finger, even Margot tears up. He keeps hold of her hand while Pastor Hicks blesses their union and proclaims them man and wife. Then Rourke leans forward and kisses Essie, and a collective sigh is heaved by the entire congregation. Cheers break out toward the back of the church, and soon everyone is clapping and throwing confetti into the air. Rourke and Essie laugh as they head down the aisle, the tiny paper hearts fluttering over and around them and landing in their hair. Margot has to pull me away and toward the exit so that we can get outside in time to meet them. On the landing out in front, we have cordoned off a small space for the final interview. Just below this, the rest of the press have set up behind a metal barrier. They are milling about aimlessly when we burst out of the side doors. Some are even sitting on the pavement, but they jump to attention at this sign that the moment is approaching. A bank of cameras begins shooting when Essie and Rourke emerge. They stop to breathe and shake the confetti out of Essie's dress, and then make their way past the velvet ropes that have been hung around our space. Both Essie and Rourke embrace Margot and me, and we all stand in a circle holding hands until the rest of the wedding party and the guests begin to pour out of the church. We nod at one another and move to our places. "Thank you for tuning in," I say into my microphone. "I'm Liberty Bell, and I'm reporting live outside the New Light Church, where I'm joined by the newly married Esther and Rourke for their first interview as husband and wife. It was a beautiful wedding, as I'm sure many of our viewers know firsthand, having attended the ceremony remotely, so to speak, through the earlier part of this broadcast. I have to admit that it was emotional for me to watch, but it must have been all the more so for you two, who were living it. Rorik, we'll let you start. How did it feel to finally marry the woman you're standing next to? Rorik grins boyishly, and I am reminded of how young they are. But he sounds composed when he begins speaking.
You're right, Libby. It was very emotional. I had trouble holding it together up there during some bits.
Well, you couldn't tell from where I was sitting, though I will say that I was way in the back, and this is an enormous space, isn't it?
It is, Essie offers. But the one thing I was always amazed at growing up is that even though the church is so big, it never makes you feel small, not while you're inside it. And I was grateful for the space today. We both were. Grateful that it allowed so many of the people we love to be here with us. What better way to start our life together than with this resounding demonstration of love from our families and our community? I tilt the microphone back toward myself and say, "There's one last thing to do, though, am I right?"
Rorik nods. "There is, but I think we're ready to take care of that right now. I see my father-in-law coming over with the marriage certificate. We'll sign it, and then it'll be official. We'll be married."
Pastor Hicks places a piece of paper on a small table behind Rorik and Essie, and they bend to sign it. They keep their bodies turned away so Margot can capture the moment, and then Essie hands the marriage certificate to me.
"I think I'll give this to you, Libby, for safekeeping. We've all got a party to get to. You're invited, of course, but maybe you would be good enough to drop it in the mail on your way?"
I laugh as if this is unexpected and take the paper and its envelope. Pastor Hicks has moved away and is standing next to Celia. They're in the shot behind Rorik and Essie, along with the rest of the wedding party. People continue to file out of the church, but the steps are crowded now. The guests are taking in the spectacle, or else waiting for Essie to throw the bouquet. I'm about to say something to wrap up the segment when I see Essie look back to Rorik. A barely perceptible nod passes between them. She turns to face me, and I feel my stomach drop.
"I know it's coming."
My mouth is dry, but I manage to croak. "Is there anything else that either of you would like to share?" Essie looks pointedly at the microphone, and I force myself to bend it toward her.
"There is, actually. And it's something that I've been thinking long and hard about because it's not easy to say. I want to tell you all, everyone watching, how lucky, just how incredibly and breathtakingly lucky, I feel to be here with Rorik today. There's been a lot of lead-up to this moment. There's been a lot of talk about flowers and dresses and my hair. And I understand the fun in that. It's every girl's dream to be a princess for a day. I got to have that. And it was magical. But to be honest, what was most special to me about this day is that I thought it would never come. I appreciate how odd that sounds coming from someone my age, someone a lot of people out there think is too young to be married, too young to make such a big decision, a forever decision. But to me, this decision was the easiest one I've ever had to make. And the fact that Rorik was so generous as to open up his heart and make this day happen for me, happen for us both, well, for that, I owe him more than I can say. Rorik's lips turn up slightly as he accepts this compliment. Or perhaps it's a look of determination, of encouragement. "It was hard," Essie continues, "to believe that I deserved a day like this. I used to think no one would ever love me. I used to think I was unlovable. I used to think that everything that happened to me was my fault, that I deserved it, Be brave, my father said during the ceremony. It's hard to be brave, but I know I have to try. That's why I want to say to every young girl who is out there listening, no one asks to be raped. I didn't. I didn't ask for it when I was 12, and I didn't ask for it 2 months ago when, after years of abuse, my rapist got me pregnant. I didn't deserve to be hurt that way, to be violated. That's why I've written a book about everything that happened to me, because if I'm going to try to be brave, it means I can't be silent anymore. There's a scream, and then I'm knocked to the ground as Margot and her camera tumble down on top of me. The crowd surges and Essie and Rourke are pulled away. I fumble for my phone, then realize that Margot still has it. My hand is shaking when she hands it back so I can dial Mike. Did you see? I gasp, cupping the phone close to my mouth, the pounding of blood in my ears louder even than the crowd. I can't believe she did that. Did you hear what she said? Upload the manuscript. Mike's voice comes to me as if through a long tunnel. I already did.
Esther. The first thing that happens when I finish talking is that there is a scream, and then Mother hits the ground. She has fainted, possibly, or else she is faking, trying to divert attention. It doesn't work. Reporters actually step over her fallen body to get closer, the metal barricade forgotten, knocked over on its side. I am vaguely aware of the annoyed look on Mother's face as Lucy helps her up. When I look back, Margot and Libby are on the ground. Caleb is close behind them. I did not see him push Margot and her camera over, but even so, I know it happened. I am jostled backward, and Rourke holds tight to my hand, but the press of the bodies is too much and we are dragged apart. I feel his fingers twist around my own, trying to find purchase, and then he is gone. The flashing lights from the horde of cameras make it impossible to see clearly, but I am aware of the closeness of the crowd. It has spilled down the steps and over much of the church lawn. The daffodils are getting trampled. Those farther back could not have heard what I was saying, but they already seem to know. Word has traveled back in a game of telephone. Like a wave traveling across the surface of still water, their smiles are replaced by something else. Even those onlookers at the periphery who had been making for their cars in an attempt to beat the traffic turn back at the commotion. Naomi emerges from one of the church's side exits. She is holding Nate and has Millicent by the hand. We lock gazes, and I see her take in the noise, the confusion, the hot flashes of anger. Then she turns and runs. The reporters are shouting questions, but I cannot hear anything distinctly. Someone grabs my arm, and I almost fall, but I am held upright by the bodies pressing it around me. I am thrust back again, and this time it is hard to breathe. My dress is getting stepped on, and the weight of other people's feet tugging at the fabric threatens to pull me down. Then there is an arm around me, and Blake throws his jacket over both our heads, shielding us from the lenses of the cameras. Together, we break free and move forward, and miraculously the sea of bodies parts to allow us through. Blake opens the door of a limousine and follows me inside. The door slams shut and muffles the shouting. He is panting.
I've got to hand it to you, Esther Ann. You sure know how to put on a show.
His face softens, and then he says,
I'm sorry.
I swallow hard, unable to answer. For a moment, I am worried that I might throw up. Instinctively, I reach out to roll down the window, but then I remember what is going on outside and stop. I see now that Rourke is pressed up against the pane of glass, and I worry that he is trapped and won't be able to open the door. I realize how stupid I have been, that people can die in crowds like this. It happens at stadiums and movie theaters. People are trampled when someone yells fire, and that's exactly what I've just done. I told myself a spectacle was what was necessary, that they would have been able to cover things up if I didn't reveal the truth in such a public way. But that's not the only reason I did it. I did it because I am selfish. I did it because I wanted to see the looks on their faces the moment that I took everything away. I swallow the rising contents of my stomach and again lean toward the window, thinking that maybe if I open it, we will be able to pull Rourke through before anyone else can poke their head inside. Then someone, an arm only, I cannot see the face, pushes a reporter back and gives Rourke just enough time to pull the door partway open. He slams it shut once he is in. His hair is standing straight up, and his shirt has come untucked.
"I almost didn't get out of there alive," he says. "The rest of them are hiding inside. I'm not sure what they're trying to accomplish. These people aren't going anywhere. They might be trapped in there for hours. Thanks for getting her out safe, man."
"No problem," Blake answers. "It's all part of the job description." The boys stare at each other, and it is clear to me that something is being communicated in this. I just don't know what it is.
"Look," Rourke says carefully, "if you want to say, I told you so, that's fair. I deserve it. I know you never really bought the whole fairy tale act, so say something if you want to, but do it now, or else drop it forever. I just want things to go back to normal."
Blake looks like he wants to answer right away, but he stops himself. His gaze swings like a pendulum from Rourke's face to mine, and back again.
"I don't think going back to normal fixes anything. It's not as if we were being honest with each other even then. And it always hurt that you didn't trust me. I just don't want there to be any more lies between us."
I see Rourke take in what Blake is really saying. He looks paralyzed, and just about as nauseated as I still feel. Finally, Blake takes Rourke's shoulder and squeezes it.
"Relax, man," he says. "I'm still the same guy I always was. And I know that you are too."
Suddenly, I begin to cry. The tears are streaming down my face, but the moment I feel them coming, I know that I am not only crying, I am also laughing uncontrollably. My body is shaking so much that my sides hurt, and the center of my chest begins to burn. 100 years ago, women would have been diagnosed with hysteria and locked up out of sight as a penalty for such emotion. But this is not 100 years or even a week ago. And for the first time, I feel just a glimmer of what it would be like to be free. When I wipe the tears from my eyes, I see that Rourke and Blake are staring at me, shocked, uncertain what to do. Then the door of the limo opens and Reggie White scrambles inside to sit across from me, and we are aware once again of the shouts of the reporters through the glass. The vehicle trembles slightly as they jostle against the door.
"It's getting a little dangerous out there," he says, "and I think we all know which one of us that crowd would consider the most expendable. So I vote that we blow out of here as soon as humanly possible." "I'm sorry for dragging you into this," Rourke tells him. "Are you kidding? That was maybe the most amazing thing I've ever witnessed. I just wish you had warned me first. Then I would have had an exit strategy planned." "Seriously, though, Essie, I don't know what to say. All this time I thought you were judging me, and it turns out I was judging you right back. I should have known better."
"Thanks," I say. A slow smile spreads across Reggie's face before he continues.
"So, is the reception still on? Because I could really go for some of those tiny hot dogs right about now."
It occurs to me that in all my scheming, I had never actually thought this far ahead. My imagination had only gotten me to the point when Thelma and Louise go off the cliff, or Carrie stands on the gym stage at her prom. I had not dared to think of what happens after. There will be a crash, certainly, but before that? Well, there's that moment when you feel like you can fly. I look at Rourke, and he shrugs.
Why not? We got married, didn't we?
We did. I tell him, sounding almost surprised. I wipe my hands across my face again. I still feel a little sick, but it is passing. And I realize that at the very least, we need some place to go until we can figure out what happens next. We can't sit in the back of a limousine forever. So I say to Reggie, I think we can probably find you enough mini hot dogs that you're never going to want to eat another one for your entire life.
That, my friend, is how you know you're throwing an epic party. Well, let's go,
Rourke says. He taps on the glass separating us from the driver, and the limo begins to pull away through the crowd. It didn't end there, of course. For a while, we were like fugitives, Rourke and I, always on the run. We graduated high school without ever setting foot in Woodside. Instead, we took our exams in a hotel room while the principal paced anxiously to and fro, or peeked out between the curtains to see if there were any press below. Rourke was valedictorian, but since he was unavailable, they asked the runner-up, Veronica Richter, to give a speech instead. She ended up talking about how everyone in the town had been complicit in what was done to me, and promptly got escorted off the stage. The stage where Rourke should have given his speech is not so different from the one where I sit now. My name is printed on a folded piece of cardboard set in front of me. There are other name cards on the long, narrow table, six in all. When I heard the list of people on the panel, I was confused about why the organizers had asked me. Compared with these other women, I have done nothing. Next to me sits an obstetrician who repairs fistulas for girls in Ethiopia. Two seats down is a young woman who was shot in Pakistan on her way home from school. I am surrounded on all sides by heroes. At home as well. As far as I'm concerned, Rourke is a hero too. When Libby and Marco decided to film a documentary about Holden Park, the first interview they did was with Rourke. He had told them about the program after Libby quit her job and was looking for something to do next. Be brave, my father had said. Rourke said this was a good motto, and since we were now a married couple, he needed to do his part. I watched him describe finding a boy who had killed himself that summer, and when he did, it was as if I was right there with him. I could practically hear the sound the body made as it was cut down and crumpled onto the floor. A member of the audience stands and is handed a microphone. Her question is for me. She wants to know what has happened to my family since my parents fled the country, since Caleb was locked up and denied bail. You can tell from the way she speaks that she believes in justice, which makes sense, because justice is what this panel on breaking the cycle of violence against women is really all about. But the truth is, I do not know if Caleb will be convicted when the case eventually goes to trial. I do not know if justice will prevail. Even though I was technically below the age of consent when the baby was conceived, other rapists have been let off with even more damning evidence against them. Men convicted of forcing themselves on women in college dorm rooms, or parked cars or behind dumpsters. Men whose crimes were witnessed by other men still walked away with a light tap on the wrist, a shake of the head, a boys will be boys, a warning to be more careful where they put their penises, to be smart enough to know which girls won't talk. The justice system has bent over backward to avoid denying these men their bright futures, has spent too much time considering their suffering, their heartache, instead of seeing them as the predators they are. Caleb, on the other hand, won't necessarily be able to depend on the old boys' club for sympathy. After all, incest is harder to dismiss. Lyssa has said she will come forward if she needs to, but for now she is staying where she's been happiest, out of the spotlight. She told me that Mother struck her hard across the face when they were still barricaded in the church, blamed her for everything that happened, accused her of putting me up to it. My sister hit Mother back. Lyssa was surprised at how shocked Mother was by the blow, but later she realized that this must have been the moment Mother knew for certain that she had lost control of it all. I tell the girl as much of this as I am able, trying to explain how it was the groundswell of public outrage that led to Caleb's arrest, despite my parents' best efforts to make it all go away, to shift the narrative, blame the victim, imply that I had somehow orchestrated it all. I tell the audience that these smears very well may have been successful had it not been for people just like them, who refused to look away, to pretend they did not see. And I thank them. I thank them for being here today. And I thank them for being there for one another, even after we have all gone our separate ways. When the session lets out, I shake hands and pose for pictures. I am also given a surprising number of hugs. On my way home, I stop to pick up the dress I will be wearing to Libby and Mike's wedding, and then climb back into my cab. When the taxi stops again, I overtip the driver and step out onto the pavement outside our building, trying not to let the thin plastic bag around my dress drag on the ground. The sidewalks are still slushy, and I am not wearing the right shoes. But I can just detect the first breath of spring in the air. I pick my way carefully between the gray puddles, and as I do, I take in the tall buildings, the general bustle of the city, the constant motion that has begun to feel like home. I am anonymous here in a way I would not have been able to hope for in any other place, except maybe overseas. We tried that for a little while, the summer after the wedding. We climbed the Eiffel Tower, explored the Louvre, then took the Channel and visited Windsor Castle and ate scones in a crooked tea house just next door. A few people recognized us, but on the whole, it was refreshing to be in a part of the world where stories like mine, like ours, seem like a tiny blip compared with the drama their royal families have wrought over the centuries. Now this city is home, is mine in a way I never expected to feel a place might belong to me, and I to it. This city is where my daughter was born. We named her Louisa, after my grandmother. She is ours, Rourke's and mine, no matter what a paternity test might say. She is beautiful, and she is loved. I stand outside our building and pause to let the sounds of the neighborhood wash over me. Then I go inside. We have a loft not far from campus. I walk there with Louisa sometimes to meet up with Rourke in between his classes. Other times I walk there on my own. I think about applying to college the way I always assumed that I was supposed to. I think about the other things I might do instead. The freedom of having a choice, and of that choice being entirely mine, seems like a miracle. I still don't know what I will do. I open the door to our apartment quietly. I like to watch my new family in those moments before they know that I am there. It's one of the things that gives me the most comfort, knowing that Louisa is all right, even when I am away. From the doorway, I can see the life that we have made together. The mismatched furniture, the scattered plastic toys, the large framed black and white photo of a papier-mâché Liberty Bell that hangs above the couch. Rourke turns and I see that he is holding Louisa. She is wearing a smocked dress that his mother sewed by hand. Louisa's hair falls in soft curls around her face as Rourke buries his face in her belly, and she throws her head back and erupts in a fit of shrieking, her face wet with spit, and the room is filled with the sound of laughter. Adam emerges from Rourke's bedroom and checks a pot on the stove. He leans over and inhales the steam, and reaches into the cupboard for some seasoning. Rourke puts Louisa down onto a playmat and begins to pull plates off a shelf to set the table. Adam joins him with the silverware and kisses him.